Coming up, we have an interview on the website The Wire with historian Avi Shlaim. Avi Shlaim has dual citizenship in both the UK and Israel. He was born in Iraq, and he is an expert on the situation.
Hello, and welcome to a special interview for The Wire. As we approach the end of 3 weeks since the start of the Israel-Hamas conflict, we ask, do we really know and understand the history of the relationship and struggle between Israel and Palestine? There are many who believe until that history is properly understood, you cannot really understand why October the 7th happened. Joining me now from Oxford is someone who is going to explain to us that history as he sees it. He's Emeritus Professor of International Relations at Oxford University and the author of seminal books on the subject, books such as Israel and Palestine, Reappraisals, Revisions, Refutations, and The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World, Professor Avi Shlaim. Professor Shlaim, in your books and essays, you trace the origin of the Israel-Palestine conflict to the 19th century Zionist movement, which sought to create an independent Jewish state in Palestine in which Jews would constitute the majority. But you say the principal problem with this project was that Palestine was already home to an Arab population that had lived there for centuries. There were therefore two peoples and one land, hence the conflict. Are you also suggesting, Professor Shlaim, that the Zionist claim to Palestine was not justified or was at least based on weak grounds?
The Zionist claim to Palestine was based on exceptionally weak grounds and misrepresentation of the reality in Palestine at the end of the 19th century. There was a very clever Zionist slogan, a country without a people for a people without a country. The slogan implied that the Jews were a people without a country, which they were, but also it implied that Palestine didn't have a people, it wasn't inhabited. But this was not true. There had been a well-constituted Arab society in Palestine for centuries. And one other Zionist claim to Palestine was also not very convincing because Zionism was a secular movement, but it also invoked divine promise to the Jews of the promised land. So the Zionists were secular. They did not believe in God, and yet they turned God into a land agent who promised them this particular plot of land. The weakness of the Zionist claim to Palestine is illustrated by the following episode. The visionary of the Jewish state was Theodor Herzl, a Viennese Jew, who wrote a pamphlet outlining his idea for a Jewish state in Palestine. And the rabbis of Vienna got together, collected some money, and sent two of their members to Palestine to check out Herzl's idea. And the two rabbis sent a telegram which became famous. It said, the bride is beautiful, but she is already married to another man. In other words, Palestine is beautiful, but there was already another people living there.
As a historian, how do you evaluate a more emotional claim that the Jews make to the land of Palestine, that it is their biblical heritage, that it is the land of Canaan, this is where Judaism started, therefore this is our home? How do you evaluate that?
That this claim is completely invalid in the modern era. in the modern era, there is international law, there are international organizations, there are international borders. And a claim that goes back to 2 millennia ago is completely untenable in the modern age, because any other people could resurrect claims that go back millennia ago. And if other people, if every people was able to assert historic rights to a land, then that is a recipe for never-ending conflict all over the world. Having said that, I don't deny the very strong emotional and historic association between the Jewish people and Zion. And Zion is one of the many names for Jerusalem. So I don't deny the association. And of course, Jerusalem is particularly of huge symbolic and religious importance to the Jewish people. The Jews for centuries have been praying, Jews everywhere have been praying, next year in Jerusalem. That was the ultimate aspiration, to return to Zion. But that doesn't make it a politically or legally valid claim to the land.
Now, Israel came into being, Professor Schleim, in 1948, and very quickly that led to the expulsion of some 750,000 Palestinians from their lands, which they called the Nakba. In an article that you wrote for The Guardian in 2009, you said, and I'm quoting you, establishing the State of Israel in May 1948 involved a monumental injustice to the Palestinians. Is that the start of the modern-day Israel-Palestine conflict, as well as the deep-seated sense of hurt and grievance that the Palestinian people feel?
1948, the establishment of the State of Israel and the first Arab-Israeli war is a turning point in the modern history of the Middle East. But I wouldn't choose that year to mark the beginning of the conflict. If I had to choose an arbitrary date for the beginning of the conflict, I would opt for 1917. That is the year in which Britain issued the Balfour Declaration in support of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. So this is a really significant document in which Britain allocated to the Jews political rights, the right to national self-determination, and denied it to the Arabs. In 1917, the Jews were only 10% of the population, the Arabs were 90%. The Jews owned only 2% of the land. And yet Britain's intervention enabled the Zionist movement to embark on the systematic takeover of Palestine, which continues to this day. So I would say that the British mandate in Palestine from 1922 to 1948 is what enabled the Zionist movement to establish itself and to eventually in 1948 to proclaim and achieve independence. Now, I have never questioned the legitimacy of the State of Israel within its original borders. These are the borders that were agreed between Israel and its neighbors in 1949, after the guns fell silent. These are the only internationally recognized borders that Israel has ever had, and the ones that I still regard as legitimate. But there is no denying that the establishment of the State of Israel involved a monumental injustice to the Palestinians. This is what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe. 3/4 of a million Palestinians, more than half the Arab population became refugees, and the name Palestine was wiped off the map. This is the Nakba. This is the catastrophe.
I'll just point out for the audience, Professor Schleim, that although you accept that 1948 was a turning point in history, the actual origin of the problem goes back to the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which is why many Palestinians believe that the original responsibility for the creation of Israel and for the problem between Israel and the Palestinians is in fact a British responsibility. And you explained that very well. Now, in the years that followed 1948, the Arab nations of the Middle East rejected Israel. They fought wars with Israel. But after the Six-Day War of 1967, when Israel captured the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights, it agreed to trade land for peace. That could have led to a solution, but Israel reneged on its commitments and instead started to build settlements in the occupied territories. Of this, you write, refusal to relinquish the fruits of its military victory turned little Israel into a colonial power ruling over a recalcitrant Arab population. Why did Israel do this? Why did it deliberately throw away the possibility of a solution?
The June 1967 war was another historic turning point in the Middle East. For the first time, Israel had something concrete that it could offer the Arabs in return for peace, because in the course of the war, Israel trebled its territory. It captured the Golan Heights from Syria, the West Bank from Jordan, and the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt. And King Hussein of Jordan, immediately after the end of hostilities, offered Israel total peace for total withdrawal. But Israel did not accept this offer, and Israel started building settlements on the West Bank and in Gaza and in the Golan Heights. Now, why did Israel not agree to trade land for peace now that it had the opportunity? The answer to that is that in the aftermath of victory, there was a convergence of secular nationalism with religious nationalism. And both secular Israelis and religious Israelis felt that this was an opportunity to realize the land of Israel. The land of Israel was a concept, and now they wanted to turn the state of Israel into the land of Israel by incorporating the West Bank into Greater Israel. The West Bank, or as right-wing Israelis prefer to call it, Judea and Samaria. They prefer the biblical rights. So it was the surge of powerful nationalism in Israel that militated against a compromise. And the settlements are the one factor that has been not only, the settlements are not only illegal, they were and they remain the main obstacle to peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
Very quickly, Professor Schleim, was this a missed opportunity, a moment when actually Israel could have established a peaceful relationship with its Arab neighbors? Did it miss the opportunity?
Most definitely, it was a missed opportunity on the part of Israel. The United Nations offered a formula for a settlement, UN Resolution 242, which offered Israel peace and security in return for giving up the territories it had conquered in the course of the war. This is a formula that worked. When Israel applied the formula 242 in 1979, it got a peace agreement with Egypt. Israel had to give back the whole of the Sinai Peninsula, but in return, it got peace. Israel could have had peace with Syria if it returned, if it agreed to return the whole of the Golan Heights to Syrian sovereignty. And as I just said, King Hussein of Jordan also offered Israel land for peace, but Israel missed the opportunity. Since 1967, Israel had a basic choice to make: its land or peace with its neighbors. And in the case of the Palestinians, Israel has opted for land in preference to peace.
Now, the next opportunity for a solution, Professor Schleim, came with the 1993 Oslo Accords. You write, Oslo achieved three things. The PLO recognized Israel. Israel recognized the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people. And the two sides agreed to resolve their outstanding differences by peaceful means. This led the Palestinians to believe that they could gain an independent state with a capital in Jerusalem. But this never happened. What went wrong? And who, in your opinion, is more to blame?
The Oslo Accord, which happened 30 years ago last month, was a very modest step in the right direction. And at the time of that the Oslo Accord was signed, I was euphoric. I thought that this is the real deal. This is the beginning of a solution, because I believed that it would start a process of gradual, controlled Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, at the end of which there would be a Palestinian state. But I was wrong. Now that the Oslo peace process broke down. Why did it break down? There are two different explanations. There is the official Israeli explanation, which says Oslo broke down because the Palestinians returned to violence. And it's terrorism that destroyed the accord. And Benjamin Netanyahu never accepted the Oslo Accord. So he rejected it from the start. My explanation is that it is Israel which, after the murder of Yitzhak Rabin and the return to power of the Likud, right-wing Likud party under the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu, this was in 1996, that Israel reneged on its side of the deal. And if you press me to say in one word the reason for the collapse of the Oslo peace process, that word is settlements. Settlements, Jewish settlements on the West Bank represents land grabbing, stealing land that belongs to the Palestinians. Land grabbing and peacemaking don't go together. It's one or the other. And by constantly expanding settlements, Israel showed that it prefers land to peace.
Let me quote from your writings. You say, the change of government from Labour to Likud had profound implications for the peace process. And the reason is Likud explicitly rejected the idea of an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. And the Likud leader was none other than Benjamin Netanyahu. So does he bear a certain measure of personal responsibility because of the position he took for the fact that the Oslo Accords collapsed and were not fulfilled?
Benjamin Netanyahu bears a very, very large share of the responsibility for the collapse of the Oslo Accords, because when he was leader of the opposition, he led a campaign of incitement against the Rabin government, against the democratically elected government, which ended with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. So he was never committed to the Oslo Accords. And once he was elected in 1996, and he was elected by a margin of less than 1%, and yet he immediately proceeded to undermine and subvert the Oslo Accords and reestablish Israeli control over the whole of the West Bank, and whereas Labour built settlements only in areas that they thought are strategically important, the Likud under Netanyahu have built settlements across the breadth and length of the West Bank in order to make territorial compromise impossible.
In fact, you make this point very strongly in your work. Since the collapse of the Oslo Accords, Israeli settlements on the West Bank have proliferated to the point that there are now some 750,000 settlers, I believe, in the West Bank. In Gaza, Israel occupied the strip. Then after vacating it, it blockaded it and surrounded it virtually from all sides, restricting imports and exports. And even when it took over the whole of Jerusalem as its capital, it once again gave a signal that there was no question of Jerusalem being shared. Does this mean that in the last 10, 15 years, maybe a bit longer, Israel has effectively buried the Oslo Accords deep underground?
It does mean that Israel has completely turned its back on the Oslo Accords. And if Israel's intention, if its purpose was to proceed to peace with the Palestinians, then it would support a strong and united Palestinian leadership. But Israel's policy, especially during the five terms of Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister, has always been divide and rule. Whenever the Palestinians manage to reconcile their differences to form a national unity government, which included Hamas and Fatah, Israel launched an operation which disrupted the national unity government. So Israel, by its actions, has shown that it is not interested in having a Palestinian partner for peace, because it is wants to maintain its control over the territories. In 2005, Israel withdrew unilaterally from Gaza, but it's for its own reasons, not part of an overall settlement.
Can I pause you there, Professor Schleim? We're going into the Israel-Hamas story, which is another very important chapter, but there are details there which my audience may not be aware of. So let's go to the beginning of that, so it helps an Indian audience who's unfamiliar understand. Hamas was founded in 1987 as an organization committed to the physical elimination of Israel. Before we go further, how would you characterize or describe Hamas, and how would you explain its ideology, in particular, the goals and principles it stands for?
Hamas is an Islamic resistance movement. And Hamas emerged in 1987 during the first Palestinian Intifada or uprising. And curiously, initially, at the beginning, Israel supported Hamas as a counterweight to the secular nationalism of the Palestinian of the PLO, of the Palestinian National Movement. So Israel already then began to play the game of divide and rule. But Hamas is a Islamic resistance movement to the Israeli occupation. And in 2006, it won a free and fair election. It won an absolute majority in an all-Palestine elections.
Before we go into that detail, I noticed that you described Hamas very carefully as an Islamic resistance movement to the Israeli occupation. Many people today insist upon calling Hamas a terrorist organization, but you did not. Is it, or has it become since its foundation, a terrorist organization? Or is that only partly correct, or is it incorrect?
It is necessary to distinguish between the political leadership of Hamas, which most certainly is not a terrorist organization, and its political leadership that adopted the parliamentary road to power and won the election in January 2006. But Hamas also has a military wing, and the military wing has committed terrorist acts. Most recently, on the 7th of October, it launched an attack inside Israel, and which involved a massacre of Israeli civilians. Attacking civilians is wrong. Killing civilians is wrong, period. There can be no debate about it. Whether Hamas kills Israeli civilians, that is wrong. And if Israel kills Palestinian civilians, as it is doing today in Gaza, that is equally wrong. And I would denounce that as state terrorism.
So you're making a distinction, Professor Schlein, between the political wing of Hamas and the military wing. The political wing, as you were saying, and we'll talk about it in further detail in a moment's time, in 2006, won a free and fair election and came to power. But the military wing has been indulging from time to time in terrorist acts. So is the military wing a terrorist organization?
The military wing is the wing, the element of a political movement, of a political party. And that military wing has committed terrorist acts in the past. But I am reluctant to describe it as a terrorist organization. I'd like to examine its actions case by case and conclude that if it attacks civilians, then that is a terrorist act. But if attacks Israeli military targets or Israeli soldiers, then that I wouldn't call as terrorism. On the contrary, I would say that a people under occupation have the right to resist under international law, and Hamas is exercising the right to resistance to the Israeli occupation, and it's the only element within the Palestinian community that is resisting the occupation, because the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah is a collaborationist body. It collaborates with Israel in perpetuating the occupation. So the Palestinian Authority is a subcontractor for Israeli security on the West Bank. That is why it has lost legitimacy in the eyes of the Palestinian people.
Now, in 2006, January, free and fair elections were held both in the West Bank and Gaza, and Hamas unexpectedly won a decisive victory over Fatah. But when Hamas formed the government, Israel refused to recognize it, and the United States and the European Union did the same. A year later, in November 2007, when Fatah and Hamas formed a government of national unity, overcoming their differences and getting together, you say Israel and the US plotted to undermine it. Was this Israeli attitude to Hamas justified by Hamas's 1987 position of wanting to eliminate Israel? Or was Hamas changing its attitude, and did Israel fail to realize the change and thus miss another opportunity?
Political movements and movements on national liberation evolve, just as the PLO evolved from an absolute rejection of Israel to a much more moderate position that culminated in signing the Oslo Accord with Israel. Hamas is a political movement which has moderated its position since the Charter of 1988, which is a very dogmatic and very even anti-Semitic document. But once it was elected, Hamas seriously moderated its position. It formed a coalition government with Fatah. The government called for negotiations with Israel for a long-term ceasefire. Israel refused to recognize the Hamas-led government, and it engaged in economic warfare to break it down. And the United States and European Union, to their shame, supported Israel in this effort to recognize, to work with Hamas-led government. Now, the Western powers claim that they are there to promote democracy. And what happened there shows how hypocritical they were, because they say they want to promote democracy, but when the people chose the wrong bunch of, when the Palestinians chose the wrong bunch of people, they turned against Hamas. And there was indeed a plot which involved Israel, America, Fatah, and Egyptian intelligence to isolate Hamas, to weaken it, and eventually to overthrow it. There was a plan to carry out a coup to drive Hamas out of power. And this led Hamas to carry out the violent seizure of power in Gaza in 2007.
And can I pause you there for a moment, Professor Schleim? Why did Israel take this attitude to Hamas? Was it because Israel failed to realize that Hamas had evolved, i.e. it was ignorant of the change and evolution taking place, or did it simply turn a blind eye and refuse to accept it?
Israel refuses to accept Hamas as a negotiating partner. Israel's position is that Hamas is a terrorist organization, pure and simple, and it will never negotiate with it. And Benjamin Netanyahu's policy has been to let Hamas rule the Gaza Strip, but to contain the Gaza Strip. And this policy collapsed because Gaza could not be contained. What Israel refuses to do is to accept that Hamas represents a serious body of Palestinians and that you cannot reach any peace agreement with the Palestinians that excludes Hamas. So the sensible thing for Israel to do and the other European powers to do is to recognize Hamas and to negotiate with Hamas for a political settlement of the conflict.
Now, you write that to preempt the coup or the plot, which you were talking about a moment ago, one in which Egyptian intelligence, Israel, the United States were all involved, Hamas violently seized power in Gaza in 2007. That not only divided the Palestinian movement between Fatah in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza, but it also set up the Hamas-Israel conflict that's virtually lasted since then. Let's talk about that conflict. Israel accuses Hamas of repeated terrorist attacks causing Israeli deaths. Hamas accuses Israel of blockading the Strip, depriving its people of development, and periodic airstrikes and even frequent or at least occasional ground invasions. How do you, as a historian, view the decade and a half since 2007?
Decade and a half since 2007 has not involved any movement, any step towards a peaceful settlement of the conflict. This is a political conflict between the two sides, but Israel only uses military force, brute military force, to suppress the Palestinians on the West Bank and in Gaza, and nothing but brute military force. There is an Israeli saying that if force doesn't work, use more force. But this is completely ludicrous. Force cannot solve the political dispute between the two sides. And Israeli generals have a phrase, to mow the lawn, to cut the grass in Gaza. This is a horrific metaphor, because what it means is that every few years, Israel goes into Gaza with very advanced weaponry, great technology, and really inflicts a huge amount of damage, not just on Hamas and its military capabilities, but also on civilians and the civilian infrastructure. And this is, mowing the lawn is a mechanical thing that you do every now and again to set back Gaza. There is no light at the end of the tunnel. So what Israel needs to do is to offer a political horizon and hope to the Palestinians of Gaza.
Now, of Israel's attitude to the Palestinians over the last decade or so, you write, and I'm quoting you, "Israel's propaganda machine persistently pervades the notion that the Palestinians are terrorists, that they reject coexistence with the Jewish state, that their nationalism is little more than anti-Semitism, that Hamas is just a bunch of religious fanatics, and that Islam is incompatible with democracy." Are you suggesting that this is not just deliberate misrepresentation, but pretty close to an outright lie?
Of course, because this is Israeli propaganda. It's completely one-sided, and it completely ignores what we've talked about before, that Hamas chose the parliamentary road to power. Hamas tried a political avenue, and every avenue that the Palestinians explore is blocked by Israel. And it's very easy for Israel to dismiss any action by Hamas as terrorist action, anything by Palestinians. But the truth of the matter is that the Palestinians are normal people. They want what every normal people wants, which is to live in freedom and dignity on their own land. And it is Israel which is preventing them from doing that. Moreover, Israel has launched successive attacks on Gaza. The first one was Operation Cast Lead in 2008. By my count, the current round of violence is the sixth Israeli assault on the people of Gaza. And all Israel has to offer is more force and demonization of the Palestinians. Israel systematically demonizes the Palestinians, all Palestinians, as terrorists. And the danger with dehumanizing a whole people is that it paves the way to ethnic cleansing and to genocide. And what we are witnessing today, day after day in Gaza, is Israeli move towards ethnic cleansing of the population and genocide.
Now, you make another very important point, and I'm quoting you. You say, "Israel claimed to be the victim of Palestinian violence. The truth," you point out, "is very different." You say, "This is a conflict between David and Goliath, but the biblical image was inverted. A small and defenseless Palestinian David faced a heavily armed, merciless, and overpowering Israeli Goliath." I have to tell you, when I read that sentence, I said to myself, this is definitely not how the West views the problem. It's a fact, it's the opposite of the Western perception.
The Western perception of the conflict is completely out of touch with reality, because it's obvious to anyone who has eyes to see that the victims in this conflict are not the Israelis, but the Palestinians. Indeed, and this is indeed a conflict between a Palestinian David and a heavily armed and overbearing Israeli Goliath. And it's the asymmetry of power between the Palestinians and the Israelis that militates against a peaceful solution of the conflict. And the West bears a large share of the responsibility for the impasse between Israel and the Palestinians, because the West is completely one-sided in its support for Israel. And we saw and America in particular gives Israel money and arms and diplomatic protection. The trouble with American support for Israel is that it is unconditional. It's not conditional on Israel obeying international law or respecting Palestinian human rights. It's this unconditional American and British and largely European Union support for Israel which enables Israel to get away literally with murder. And we saw during this crisis, Joe Biden and Rishi Sunak and other European leaders rushed to Israel to visit, to show their support for Israel, but they haven't called for a ceasefire. Surely the decent thing to do in the present situation is to call for a ceasefire. Hamas has offered to release the civilian hostages in return for a ceasefire, but it is Israel that is refusing to stop its bombardment of Gaza.
Now, Professor Schleim, it was against this background, which we've discussed in some detail, that Hamas launched its October 7 attack. Does the history that we've discussed explain why that attack happened, even if it certainly cannot justify it or even excuse it? And I'm making that clear to the audience. It's not that the history justifies or excuses the attack, but does it explain it?
The 7th of October attack by Hamas in Israel has attracted a huge amount of denunciation for a very good reason, because it was an attack on civilians. So I denounce the Hamas attack on Israeli civilians inside Israel. And much of the commentary speaks about the 7th of October as a barbaric attack. What many commentators forget is that the conflict did not start on the 7th of October. The conflict has to be seen against 56 years of Israeli occupation since 1967. The Israeli occupation of the Palestinian lands is a daily violence against the Palestinians. And when Israel withdrew from Gaza unilaterally in 2005, it effectively turned Gaza into a prison, into the biggest open-air prison in the world. And it imposed a blockade already in 2007, a blockade of Gaza, which is illegal. It's a form of collective punishment. Now, since the 7th of October, Israel has intensified the blockade and committed war crimes by cutting off water, food, electricity, fuel, and medical supplies to the population of Gaza. So the conflict didn't start on the 7th of October, and the action by Hamas has to be seen as an act of resistance to the Israeli occupation. And the history that we have reviewed briefly in our conversation, it doesn't justify the attack of Hamas on the 7th of October, but it surely is the explanation. Surely it gives the backdrop to what has happened. Israel tried to contain the prison, and now the prisoners have broken out of the prison. And there is a Jewish-American writer called Norman Finkelstein who has described this as the revolt of the slaves. It's the underdogs who have taken the initiative in breaking the siege.
A sort of modern-day Spartacus.
Indeed, that's quite an interesting historical comparison, absolutely.
Now, in your writing, Professor Schleim, you make three broad thematic points about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and I'd like to touch on them briefly before I end. First, you say, Israelis regard themselves as victims But then you tellingly add, feeling themselves to be the victims tends to blind the Israeli majority to the suffering they inflict on the real victims in this conflict, the Palestinians. Are you saying there that Israelis are oblivious to, or at least blind to, the sufferings they have inflicted on the Palestinians?
Yes. And the Israeli media is a loyalist media that follows the party line, the government line. And there is very little reporting of what happens on the other side of the hill, what happens in the occupied territories. So Israelis are largely ignorant of what happens on the other side. And they also have a tendency to see themselves as victims. History explains why this should be so. The Jews have suffered a great deal. The Jews endured the Holocaust. The Holocaust explains why Jews, why Israelis are so obsessed, so concerned, almost obsessed with security. But this acute preoccupation with Israeli security does blind Israelis to the insecurity of the other. Israel demands 100% security for itself. This translates into 100% insecurity for the Palestinians, as we are witnessing today in Gaza. So yes, the Israeli public is not well informed about the rights and wrongs or about the history of this conflict. And its leadership, especially Benjamin Netanyahu, plays a major role in misinforming the public about the reality of the situation and about the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people.
You make another very important point, Professor Schleim, about what you call Israel's preoccupation with security. And I'll quote you. You say, preoccupation with security makes Israelis susceptible to politicians who are unscrupulous enough to manipulate the sense of threat and inflate it for political advantage. The arch manipulator, you say, is Benjamin Netanyahu. He is the high priest of fear who never stops harping on the existential threats facing the country. Does this explain why he served for 15 or 16 years as prime minister, the longest ever in Israel's history?
There are many reasons for Benjamin Netanyahu's political success in being the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history. This is one of them, but there are other factors as well. But just to focus for a moment on his manipulation of the sense of threat, this is his hallmark. This is his most distinctive position, to always exaggerate the existential threat to Israel. And he for decades he's been saying that Iran poses an existential threat to Israel. Well, Iran doesn't. Israel has a monopoly of nuclear weapons, and Israel threatens Iran. And it's for this reason that the Iranians feel so strongly that they need to acquire nuclear weapons to counter the Israeli threat. So Iran isn't an existential threat to Israel. And Netanyahu has been saying repeatedly that Hamas poses an existential threat to Israel. Well, Hamas doesn't. Hamas is a very small, poorly equipped organization, which poses no threat to Israel's basic security, which engages in terrorism, in pinpricks, or more serious attacks on Israel, but no threat to its security. And terrorism is the weapon of the weak. And Netanyahu is a great manipulator, and also Netanyahu has misled the Israeli public into thinking that the Palestinians are finished, that Israel has defeated them. They are defeated people. Israel has a free hand to do whatever it likes on the West Bank, and Israel has effectively sealed Gaza off, and it ceased to be a problem. The attack on the 7th of October meant the collapse of the Netanyahu policy of dealing with the Palestinian issue.
Now, the third broad thematic point I want to take up is actually one you've hinted at earlier in an earlier answer. It's about the West, but I think it's important for me to repeat it for the audience. You write, and I'm quoting you, the Western policy of refusing to engage with Hamas, of supporting Israel's abuse of the right to self-defense, and of supplying it with weapons that are repeatedly used to bomb a defenseless people is morally indefensible. In other words, are you saying that the West bears much of the blame for the repeated failure to resolve the Israel-Palestine problem, and perhaps also for the trauma that the Palestinians have had to live through for at least 56 years, if not a lot longer?
Israel bears the largest part of the responsibility for dispossessing and oppressing the Palestinian people. The Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories is the most prolonged and brutal military occupation of modern times. But the West also bears a part of the responsibility for the present impasse, because the West, or because of its massive support for Israel, its supply of arms to Israel, its diplomatic protection of Israel by use that's Britain and America use the veto at the Security Council to defeat every resolution that is critical of Israel. And Britain and America are opposed to the investigation by the International Criminal Court of war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. This is very revealing. There is an International Court of Justice, and there is a case for investigating war crimes, both by Hamas and by Israel. And yet, both Britain and America are opposed to the investigation of Israel in the International Criminal Court. That means that they consider Israel to be above international law and above international scrutiny. This is why this unconditional character, this unconditional nature of Western support for Israel is what accounts for, as I said earlier, the fact that Israel can act with impunity. The fact that Israel, until now, has been able to get away literally with murder, and Israel is committing murder on a massive scale every day in Gaza. But I have one glimmer of hope about the future, and that is that there is a complete disconnect between Western governments and the people of these Western countries. The governments are blindly, uncritically supportive of Israel, whatever it does, but the people in America and in Europe and in Britain are increasingly and overwhelmingly pro-Palestinian. And I hope that eventually Western foreign policy will catch up with the sentiments of the people in the street.
Let me pick up briefly, Professor Schleiman, something you said in that answer. And you've also written about it in a piece that you did as recently as May 2019. That piece ends with the following sentence, and I'm quoting you. It's the specific duty of the International Criminal Court to hold Israel to account for the war crimes it committed in the past and its ongoing assaults on the people of Gaza. As someone who served proudly and loyally in the Israeli army in the mid-1960s. Do you really mean that about your own country?
I served proudly and loyally in the IDF in the mid-1960s because at that time, the IDF was true to its name. It was the Israel Defense Forces. It was a regular army that was there to defend the country against attack from the regular armies of the surrendering Arab states. Everything changed in June 1967. Israel trebled its territory. It occupied territory from all its neighbors. And my little army was changed, and Israel became a brutal colonial power, oppressing millions of Palestinians in the occupied territories. And the IDF was transformed into a brutal police force of a brutal colonial power. That is where I part way with Israel. But I emphasize again that I don't question Israel's legitimacy within its 1949 armistice borders. What I reject totally and reject completely is the Zionist colonial project beyond the Green Line. And one last sentence about the ICC, because that's another illustration of Western double standards. The last prosecutor, chief prosecutor, instituted a full investigation of war crimes. But the present chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, a British barrister, has completely failed to progress that investigation. On the other hand, when Russia invaded Ukraine, within 2 days, he announced that he's going to institute a war crimes investigation. And within a week, he sent an advance team to Kyiv to start gathering the evidence for a war crimes trial, investigation and trial. So you couldn't have a starker example of Western hypocrisy than condoning everything, all the war crimes that Israel commits, but supporting the ICC in its pursuit of Russian war crimes in the Ukraine.
A quick confirmation and one last question before I end. The confirmation is this. Do you believe horrific and horrible and indefensible as what Hamas did may have been? Do you believe that the Israeli response on Gaza since the 7th of October also constitutes a war crime, also constitutes something that the ICC should investigate?
Without doubt, the current Israeli onslaught on the people of Gaza constitutes a war crime. And this is nothing new. The first Israeli attack on the people of Gaza was in 2008 and 2009. And then there was the Goldstone Report, 575 pages. It deals with 33 episodes, and it details not one, not two, not three, but a whole series of Israeli war crimes. And Israel did not have to pay any price for committing those war crimes in 2008 and 9, or in any of the subsequent five attacks on Gaza. So Israel is a war criminal. Israel repeatedly commits war crimes in Gaza, and it doesn't suffer any consequences.
My last question, Professor Schleimer. How do people in Israel, your fellow citizens, regard your views and your thinking and your comment on Israel? How do they respond when you say, and I'm quoting what you said to me, Israel has committed murder on a massive scale every day. You said Israel was guilty of state terror. You said Israel was guilty of war crimes and you called it a war criminal. How do your fellow Israelis respond to you when you speak in these terms and when they hear your views?
It depends which Israelis. Israelis on the left share my views, but the majority of Israelis who know about me, and I'm not that well known in Israel, would probably regard me as a traitor. What is important to me is the truth. I'm a historian. My main research interest is the Arab-Israeli conflict. So what I care about most is not what some Israelis think of me, but my duty as a public intellectual and as a student of this conflict to give the public in my publications, in my books, in my articles, and in conversations with people like you, to give an account of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is as truthful as possible, as honest as possible, and as fair-minded as possible. That is my agenda.
Professor Schleim, I thank you for giving me so much time to explain a very complicated and complex subject in ways that are simple and easy for an Indian audience to understand. People may not completely agree with your view and interpretation of Israel-Palestine history, but at least they will have heard from you a view that they ought to pay a lot of attention to, and which places what happened on the 7th of October in a perspective that many in the media have not as yet conveyed. You've opened their eyes. Now it's for them to look out and see and believe. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to me.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Hi, I'm Karan Thapar. Over the last few years, I hope you've been watching my program, The Interview on the Wire. During that period, I've interviewed doctors, politicians, businessmen, scientists, authors, and even the occasional Nobel laureate. For me, it's been exciting. I hope it's been enjoyable for you. But these, as you know, are tough times. And if this program is going to remain bold, independent, and sometimes even defiant, then I think we need your support. At the end of the day, it's a truism, but editorial independence is best defended by the viewers. So if you would like this program to remain the way it is, forthright, outspoken, and interesting, then would you consider supporting us? All you have to do is to click on the description at the bottom. But more than anything else, I hope you will continue to watch The Interview. Your viewership means an awful lot to me.